This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. The political battles are over. Now the legal fights are underway. Governor McCrory is looking over a slew of bills passed this last session by the General Assembly. He's already signed some of them into law and vetoed others. He approved a controversial voter ID bill. He vetoed a bill that would require welfare recipients to pass drug tests and another bill on immigration. Meanwhile, questions remain about the legal consequences of this legislation. One bill would allow lawmakers to intervene in lawsuits against the state in case the attorney general decides not to or not to fight hard enough. Another would let judicial discipline proceedings occur in secret and give the Supreme Court the right to discipline itself. Here to talk about these and other legal issues are Bill Marshall and Richard Myers, professors at the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill Law School, and Justice Willis Wichard is the only North Carolinian ever to serve in both houses of the legislature and both of the state's appellate courts. Welcome to all of you. Good to have you on the program. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Richard Myers, let's start with the voter ID law. Now it is law. It was signed into law last week. Opponents are planning legal challenges. They say this is obviously, for them, interference with the right to vote.
I think where you stand in some ways depends on where you sit on that particular issue. I think there's a significant support for the bill from a large number of the population. In the abstract, many, many people think it's a good idea. You know, it's an important thing. The right to vote should be handed out to everyone who deserves it and not to those who don't. So I think I'm one of those folks who supports the idea in the abstract, but thinks the devil's in the details.
Well, the details, people are saying, and that's what you take to court, right? You're going to take a look at how people have access to these IDs, what kinds of ID they're going to have to bring if they've lost their birth certificate, et cetera. Is that going to matter to the court? And if you show that most of the people who might be affected by this are either poor or perhaps African-American, if you could show that in court, would that then have any kind of standing? Would it have merit as a legal argument?
I think the law school answer is it depends, and I think that that's true here as well. It depends on whether or not you think the disparate impact, which is what we would be talking about, we'd say this has a disparate impact on one class or another, has risen to the level where we're actually depriving folks on the basis of race. The numbers I've seen suggest it's about 60-40 in terms of who would be affected, in terms of Republicans versus Democrats. That is 60% of the folks who wouldn't have ID would be Democrats and 40% Republican, and we're talking about 130 to 140,000 people based on the 2012 elections. I pulled the Board of Elections numbers and took a look. So at the end of the day, I think how you implement it and how easy you make it for other folks to get it makes a huge difference. And we've had – Texas has had one overturned. Georgia's had one upheld. So the details really do matter.
Bill Marshall, what about this one?
You know, what's interesting about this is a solution looking for a problem, as somebody else has described it. There's very little evidence that this kind of voter fraud actually takes place, maybe a dozen votes in any particular cycle. It's not a particularly hard thing to discover if it was taking place. There are people out on the street who would see that other people are trying to encourage folks to vote when they can't, but there's no evidence of this. It creates an enormous burden on people who do not have an ID. If you don't have a driver's license, usually, if you don't have other kinds of ID, there's a reason for that. Nobody wants to have to go to the DMV under any circumstances if they can avoid it to get an ID of any type. When you add how many types of proof they would have to show, when you add the cost that can be for somebody who doesn't have a car to get across town or to get to a DMV that may not even be in their township, this is a substantial burden, and I don't think it's any accident as to why the legislature tried to create this burden, because it thinks that a lot of the people who will who vote without having this kind of ID are not going to vote for them.
All right, but that seems to me the political argument, that and the fact that – and in fact, there has been rigorous study on voter fraud at the polling place, and it's shown, as you suggested, very little of it. So it has been studied, and the study shows very little. So that's a political argument. What voter fraud there is happens in absentee balloting. That is far more likely to happen and has happened. That was not addressed by the Republican legislature. absentee balloting favors the Republican Party. Those are all political arguments. The legal argument, is there any reason on earth why a legislature can't pass a law that says you have to prove who you say you are when you go exercise the franchise?
Well, again, I think I have to – this may be the only time in this hour that I'll agree with Richard, but I think part of it, it depends on the circumstances. It depends on what the impact looks like. But I do think that what will go into the legal analysis is how strong the state's interest is. And if you don't show that there is a problem here that they're trying to solve, that there is a real problem here, it's going to weaken the case for upholding the legality of the provision.
Justice Wichard, what do you think?
I suppose the legal argument would be an equal protection one. And I think the state can solve that by making sure there are available means for people without identification to get it. I agree with what has been said earlier that the fraud is phantom. There's just been no evidence that it's there. The legislators would certainly have brought that forth in their arguments on the floor of the houses had they had it. I think Professor Myers is right. It is not on its face unconstitutional. It perhaps could be shown to be constitutional as applied, and that's a case-by-case thing.
And then again, legally, if you add the argument, well, what is the state's interest in this? There has been no evidence of it. Even the governor said the governor believed it hadn't been studied, so he was ready to sign the law, even though there was no proof of fraud, right? And in fact, there is proof of no fraud. But that aside, okay, so there's not much evidence and a 60-40 split may be a burden. I'm trying to figure out how a court might weigh this legal question that might be before it. Do they start adding these things up? Little burden on this kind of a voter, wasn't much reason. Is it a cumulative thing, or do you have to make a knockout punch in any one of these issues? Let me start with you, because you've served on the court.
I think it could be either.
I'm going to law school. It depends and can be either.
I think you could have an as-applied challenge based on any one thing. If you're going to frontally attack the law, I think it's got to be a cumulative effect.
I see.
The courts will look first at what's the state's interest, but you also have the state's interest in trust in the integrity of the system. And if you've got 70%+ of folks thinking this is common sense and something we already thought was happening, that is actually, I think, more going to weigh in the balance than folks who are opposed to it are willing to concede. So I think there's a significant state interest on one side. And then the question becomes, what are the burdens you're going to place on people on the other side? I do think the state should do its absolute utmost to make sure that folks who don't have these IDs can get them and get them free, to the point if it was up to me, I'd be sending vans to folks' homes with a way for them to be handed their ID at their house.
Yeah, I don't think we're seeing that they're going to be sending vans to people's house to do it, because there's nothing that I've seen in the bill which indicates it's going to alleviate the burdens on people, many of whom who do not have easy access to transportation, many of them who do not have easy access to be able to go to places where the IDs are being issued, many of those who do not have the kinds of proof that the bill requires. And I do think that the burden that's being imposed upon the people without ID is considerable, and I do think the court will take a look at it. I agree that we don't know yet how these cases are going to come out, and I think the fact that there have been divergent results from state to state indicates that the way that the case is litigated and the facts that are brought to fore may lead to the actual result that will take place in North Carolina.
Photo ID is only one part of it. There's also restrictions on students and where they may vote. They may not vote from their campus. They have to go home if they have an address in North Carolina. Restrictions on early registration for 18-year-olds. Restrictions limiting the number of weeks for early voting, reducing that by one, albeit increasing the number of precincts and increasing the number of hours. How much of that is part of the legal argument? And again, none of those restrictions, it seems to me, speak to the issue of fraud.
I think that's right. The states traditionally have the authority to set all of these things. It's within the power of the legislature. And if one of the things is elections have consequences, so the legislature gets to decide. that what that means ultimately for a legal challenge is you have to add those all up and say, taken together, do we consider that sufficiently weighted in one direction, not the other, and not on the basis of politics, but on the basis of something invidious? You're allowed to do things to help you politically. That's one of the things we do in our system. So thinking about whether that's crossed the line to an invidious racial discrimination is going to be – you will add them all up. You'll look at them all together, and I think that's part of it.
I think the change that will have the largest impact is one you didn't mention, and that's the elimination of straight ticket voting. We're sitting in Durham County. In the 2008 election, Durham County had the highest percentage of straight Democratic voting in the country, at about 76%, as I recall it. If you think about it, it's simply the law of physics that if you've got to mark – in 2016, you will have the long ballot. You will be electing a president, governor, lieutenant governor, council of state – state legislators, county commissioners, county clerk, register of deeds, sheriff, you're going to have to make some 15 to 20 marks as opposed to one. And you think about the cumulative effect of that. And that is going, in my view, to tend to repress the vote more than a voter ID provision. You simply can't calculate it physically to make it work.
Remember when the Democrats did that and they took the president off straight ticket voting when Richard Nixon was on the ballot? Anybody remember? I just thought it's my due diligence. Wanted to point that out. We're going to keep talking about the legal effects of this state legislature with Bill Marshall, Richard Myers, professors of law at UNC Chapel Hill Law School. Justice Willis Wichard has been on the legislature and the courts in North Carolina. We'll continue our conversation on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking about legal issues stemming from the recent session of the General Assembly. Bill Marshall, Richard Myers are professors of law at the University of North Carolina Law School at Chapel Hill, and Justice Willis Wichard, the only North Carolinian, we'll point it out again, who served both the houses of the legislature in North Carolina and both of the state's appellate courts. Let's turn our attention now to a law that gives two legislators standing in the court to represent the state should the attorney general decide not to defend the state against legal challenges. Bill, this is something that you've actually worked on. You've done this kind of work in a state's attorney general's offices. So tell us about this.
Yeah, not here, but in Ohio. You know, the fact is that when you're in an attorney general's office, you're expected to defend laws with which you might disagree with all the time. And we did, and we did it well. Sometimes I think I defended a law I disagreed with better than the one I agreed with because I understood the opposing arguments so incredibly well. And that's what an AG is supposed to do. And that's when a state such as North Carolina has a divided executive in which you have a governor with some kinds of responsibilities in an AG for others. That's what the constitutional design is supposed to do, is put those decisions with the AG's office. So this is a very unusual law that, again, I think is reacting to a problem that certainly we haven't seen in North Carolina at all, and you don't see in the vast majority of attorney general's offices throughout the country.
We did see it in California, where the attorney general there refused to defend the state against its domestic partners and marriage, gay marriage act and law. So it does happen, and I'm sure that's what they're reacting to. So I guess the question is, Richard Myers, you know, is it legal? Can you do this kind of thing?
Yes, you can. Whether or not it's good policy and whether or not it may run into constitutional design issues in North Carolina because of the way our divided executive works might be a different question. But you can create standing for other folks to defend legislation. It's been done in other places. Interestingly, in California, in the gay marriage case, the California Supreme Court said that the person did have standing to defend the state of California. The Supreme Court didn't recognize it. So it was actually a very interesting split there as a question of state law, who decides who's what constitutes the person with standing. So going forward, I think there's the interesting question as well about whether or not as an independent actor, the attorney general has to decide for himself whether or not he thinks something constitutional, because then you have a separate duty as well not to violate the Constitution.
Right. So you would expect that they're going to have to act, but then the question is how you're hoping the professional ethics and standards apply. Well, Justice Wichert, what do you think here?
I will venture a guess that it will be upheld. I will say that the courts will be reluctant to upset it. And frankly, there are practical dimensions to that we've seen in our history going back to the 1787 case of Byard against Singleton, which established the principle of judicial review in North Carolina some 16 years before John Marshall did it for the country in Marbury versus Madison. That court was very reluctant to declare a statute unconstitutional and actually adjourn court for a couple of months and urge the lawyers to go settle it. When they finally had to pass on it, they did what they had to do for a constitution to mean anything. But I tend to think the legislature can give itself the authority to do that. They could have, in any event, filed amicus briefs in any case.
Right.
When I was the junior justice on the Supreme Court, which I did for a little over 5 years, I entered all the orders for the court, and my instructions were, don't even come to the rest of the court if somebody wants to file an amicus brief, just enter the order. We're going to let them do that. Arguing the case was a different thing. We would allow oral argument by an amicus only if the party right. with which the amicus was aligned ceded some of their time. But I think they can do this. I agree that it wasn't necessary. There's no evidence that the Attorney General has not been and would not continue to fulfill his or someday her perhaps constitutional or statutory duty to attempt to uphold the laws enacted by the General Assembly.
Well, it's interesting because if you look at the converse of this, there's no way to test it. So, for instance, when the Reagan administration announced it wasn't going to enforce equal opportunity laws, federal regulations through its Justice Department, there was really no test. There was no way to say, well, but wait a minute, we passed this law, get busy, get busy. It just was neglected. And so it's interesting that it comes to the court in two ways. One, you could test the constitutionality of this particular law. The other is when they decide to stand before a court, the judge can say yes or no, Mr. Tillis, you may or may not represent the state of North Carolina, right? Could that happen on a case-by-case basis? Without testing the law. You've got a law, it's on the books, nobody's bothered to test that, but now, here we come, I'm standing before the Supreme Court, I'm Phil Berger, Roy Cooper's home.
My strong suspicion is it won't be tested until then. You won't get a test in the abstract of the legislation. Case or controversy is the requirement in most places in the United States. As you have to have a live case first so that you have enough practical impact and practical effect for the courts to squarely consider it. So I suspect this won't be tested until Mr. Berger or Mr. Tillis is standing before the court attempting to represent the state.
And Justice Scalia says, who's that guy? I don't think it's going to go like that. Let's move on. A big issue for us in this state is wrongful conviction. Exonerees Greg Taylor, Floyd Brown won multi-million-dollar lawsuits from the State Bureau of Investigation. Prisoner Larry Lamb exonerated in the case of a fatal shooting, paving the way for his release. Let's talk about just what these cases and others that we've talked about in this program and go back even further. Tell us about our criminal justice system. Do we have a problem in the system? Richard, let me start with you.
I think this tells us something good and something bad. I'm really proud to be North Carolinian right now as somebody who teaches criminal law because we've got the North Carolina Actual Innocence Inquiry Commission. We've got a North Carolina Innocence Center that Chris Moomer runs that is at the forefront of pushing us in the direction of getting it right. We've had a bipartisan coalition in the state that helped put that legislation in place because if you're just a law and order type, if someone was wrongfully convicted, that means the person who did it is still running around doing something more. So I think we've had good politics in this state around the issue. I think the fact we have to really push some of our district attorneys to look at cases where it's becoming clear there's real evidence, suggests we have some work left to do. I'm hoping that the Conference of District Attorneys, and I know many of them, will really start thinking hard about conviction integrity and thinking about what that means.
Bill?
Yeah, I think there's a good part that there is a check in North Carolina, but the bad part is that when you have wrongful convictions, I'm sure these are not the only ones that are out there. These are hard to discover. You have a system in which public defenders are incredibly overburdened. In many cases, they don't have the resources to be able to properly investigate whatever defenses might be available or to present them. When you have that kind of volume and that kind of pressure, it's pretty hard for the system to come to accurate decisions most of the time. And I think that we need to have a system that protects people because, again, it's not just the innocent being convicted. It's the guilty who are right. who are out there who are, haven't been convicted because the wrong person has. So there's a lot to be gone there. But putting money into the criminal justice system is not a political priority.
Well, and if it might be if more money went into these exonerations, but they're hard to get. And I want to ask you about this, Willis, because even those who have been wrongfully convicted, right, can have to go through a lot of hoops to have to be remunerated and to have a full exoneration and actually get these multimillion dollar settlements, which if there were more of them, and if you would imagine those convicted, wrongfully convicted, if everybody got those, then there'd be an incentive, wouldn't there, to kind of clean up the process. So why is it so hard to get an exoneration and remuneration?
Let me say I'm not familiar in any detail with these suits that resulted in awards for these particular people who have been found innocent. It is my impression that it's based on some sort of wrongdoing by the state, not simply a mistake of a jury convicting based on circumstantial evidence. I will say in my 18-plus years of appellate judging, I found every circumstantial evidence case troublesome. The question for the appellate court is, was there sufficient evidence to go to the jury? And if there was, then it's a jury decision. I think what we're looking at here is where you have prosecutorial misconduct. Money cannot really compensate for losing a large portion of your life, but it's the best we can do. And I agree with Professor Myers. I think our actual Innocence Commission, the work Chris Muma, who's a Carolina law grad, has done, speaks very well for the state, but will never undo all of the wrongful convictions. There are bound to be some out there that we'll just never know about.
We did a fair amount of reporting on actual innocence earlier this year, and you can take a look at some of that and hear some of the testimony at our After Innocence link on our homepage to read more about exoneration. Well, so one of the things we used to have, Richard, in this state that, again, was a check against this sort of thing was a Racial Justice Act, in which you could – a law that allowed you to prove that if racial discrimination played any part in your death sentence, you could have it commuted to a life sentence. That was overturned by the state legislature. Did we need that act?
Well, I think it was a brilliantly named act. And how can anyone be against racial justice? If I were naming it, I would have called it the Statistical Evidence of Possible Error Maybe Act. And I think that there's just a difference there in what the question is. I think we do have cases where there's been racial infection in the criminal justice system, and we need to root that out. Absolutely. The way we were going about doing it, I'm not sure, ended up being more than a flank attack on the death penalty and the jury system in some ways. So I think there's a real problem. I think there are some solutions. I'm not sure this was a huge loss in terms of the mechanism.
Bill?
I think we should have let it work out a little bit longer. It didn't last for very long. We didn't see how well it worked. I think that the idea that it was trying to address is a real one. I don't think anybody doubts in North Carolina there's a lot of evidence to show that race has had a major part in convictions. And being a little bit more prophylactic, throwing a little bit more caution into the process to make sure that that didn't affect the criminal justice system, I think, is a good one. One of the ways that you create that kind of deterrence is having the kind of aftercheck that this bill created. So I think that if we take a look realistically at the state of the North Carolina justice system, that this was a good bill to have, or at least a good bill to see how well it would work, because we know that there's a problem there. And it's a serious one.
Well, yeah, Richard, if you get back to the voter ID, again, there was a problem. There wasn't much evidence. But that you, as you suggested, there was this common sense idea that why allow the problem to exist in the first place? So let's create this safeguard. Wouldn't that be the same argument that applies here when racism has played such a big part in so many aspects of social and legal life in this country and in this state?
Well, and I want to be clear that I'm not opposed to having second look mechanisms and the nature of second look mechanisms. The question really is the use of statistical evidence, who gets to decide the numbers and how you're going to work out when and if that constitutes sufficient basis to overturn a conviction. I'm a huge believer in our second look mechanisms. I think making them specific and tailored to individual cases is the best way to do it.
Willis Wichard.
The Supreme Court many years ago tried to get at this in the Batson against Kentucky case, which said that you cannot use race as a basis for exercising peremptory challenges. That obviously is incapable of strict enforcement. You can't really judge what motives are without some sort of tangible evidence about that. So in an ideal system, we wouldn't need this, but the system is not ideal. I think the act, there was a useful purpose for the act, and the fact that in the cases that were tried under this act, racial prejudice was found, I think tells us something.
And on the hunch that you're not going to get your Perry Mason confession from the jurors that that all said, yes, I'm a racist and I couldn't wait to try this case to send that man to his death, what other evidence would you have except that it happens an awful lot in this county where white victims, et cetera? I mean, what other evidence is there?
Well, and I guess my thought is, how do you fix that on the other side? You're a prosecutor. You've fairly struck jurors who don't belong on your jury. You've put on fair evidence. You've got the victim sitting over there. The jury's looked at it. The jury – and that's why I think in some ways it ends up as a collateral attack on the jury system. Jurors are not going to be uniform. They're not machines. They're going to be swayed by argument that appears in front of them. They're going to identify or not identify with witnesses. They're going to agree or disagree with arguments. They're going to identify or not identify with victims. And that's going to look different in different societies. I'm not sure how you fairly come back as a prosecutor against an argument that says, well, we've run these statistics and you were wrong.
But I think that – let's take a look again. I think it's worth looking at this in the overall context of what's gone on in the legislature this year, because I think the analogy to voter ID is exactly right, the one that you just made, Frank, which is there we have no problem that we're putting all kinds of procedural safeguards to try to prevent that we know is going to have a disparate effect on the poor and on African Americans. And here, when we know that we really do have a problem that's nobody denies takes place, we are getting rid of the procedural safeguards that might stop that from occurring. And you know, where's the unifying principle here?
I want to move on to at least one other issue that was another law that would allow for judicial discipline proceedings to happen in secret and let the Supreme Court discipline its own members. Willis Wichard.
Well, again, what's the problem? This came out of the blue. It was not what in my legislative days we called an agency bill. The Judicial Standards Commission did not ask for this. The courts did not ask for it. The statements that were in the paper from the sponsoring legislators were that four members of the Supreme Court wanted it. We've had a system that's worked pretty well, I think. The proceedings of the Judicial Standards Commission are secret until some charge is brought, but once a charge is brought, they're public. Why the if four members of the Supreme Court indeed asked for this, they were, of course, opposed by the Chief Justice, who wrote in opposition. The Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals, who chairs the Judicial Standards Commission, wrote in opposition to it. We now have a large group of former North Carolina Bar Association presidents seeking to have the governor veto it, and this is a first. The Bar Association has never sought a gubernatorial veto before. So I'm not sure what the problem is they were trying to address, and I think inevitably something like this creates suspicions in the public mind.
Richard Myers?
I think sunlight's the best disinfectant, so I'm inclined to say exactly what Justice Wichard said. I think I'm not sure what the driving force is behind it, and the explanations we've received don't match up with the actions we've taken in my mind.
Bill?
I mean, it's the same thing. I mean, one of the – we should have at least had the problem explained that was trying to be addressed here. And I think that what's happened so much this term is that there have been so many actions taken without any explanation at all or any hearings that would shed light on the problem.
And the potential for disaster, let me ask you this, the idea that a disciplinary procedure could go without revelation, that a bad judge could potentially stay on the bench and that those legislators who helped them, the potential here for even if it never happened, mistrust, is that a worry?
Well, we were talking about the perception of integrity before, and I think it doesn't get any greater than when you're dealing with the judiciary. I mean, if there's one place where you need a perception of integrity above all else, it's this.
There's an inherent conflict of interest with the Supreme Court judging its own members as well. Historically, the Court of Appeals has been the judge and jury if it's a Supreme Court justice. I frankly don't remember a charge being brought against a Supreme Court justice in the now 40-some years we've had this, the Judicial Standards Commission, but I think another body should be the judge when it's a member of that court.
I'm out of time, but I want to thank all of you for being on this program. Attorney and Justice Willis Wichard is, as we've said, the only North Carolinian ever to serve on both houses of the legislature and the state's appellate court. Thank you for being on the show. Bill Marshall, Richard Myers, professors of law at UNC's Chapel Hill Law School. Thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Coming up, Superchunk out with its 10th album. They're going to play live. Stay tuned.